Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, February 17th, 2014. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com.
Today, you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, can it be that mammograms are no longer necessary or even indicated?
And can insomnia increase your cancer risk?
And what about melatonin? Can it cure or help breast cancer patients?
And how can third-hand smoke?
What kind of smoke? Third-hand smoke?
Third-hand smoke be more dangerous than smoking.
Oh, well, I got to hear this one. And how friendly bacteria can help us lose weight. Here we go again. The microbes in the gut can regulate our appetite or they can change what we absorb. What do?
They do a little bit of everything,
we'll
I think.
We'll find out.
So here's a shocker that'll play havoc with your mind. The February 2014 issue of the British Medical Journal published a very important study showing that the trials from the 1960s to the 1980s that indicated mammogram screenings reduced deaths from breast cancer and as a result have been the accepted gold standard for all of these years have now been uncovered as incorrect. In fact, a recent Canadian prospective clinical trial outcome shows that mammograms discover more cancers, which lead to unnecessary overtreatment. However, the mortality rate for women who have mammograms is no different from those who don't.
So wow, say that again, Vicki. That's a big statement.
The mortality rate for women who have mammograms is no different from those who don't have mammograms.
That is a shocker.
So the conclusion of the study is that mammograms do not save lives.
Wow. And this is a 25-year study on 90,000 women out of Canada. This is a big deal. And what it does is it goes back to show that the way you collect your data and the kind of research that you do makes a difference. This study, I should say, the bulk of the studies that have been done that have led to our saying that we're reducing the deaths from breast cancer by 15% to 25% in women aged 50 to 70, those studies were done in what's called a retrospective study, which means the studies have already been done. Then you go back and collect the information and hope that when they compared the groups in the studies that they were looking for, what they did was actually have no bias, meaning no differences that are significant in the groups they were comparing. But when you do a prospective study, which is a different kind of study, where you take one group of people that are homogeneous, one big mixed up group of people, and divide it into two sections and then follow them over 25 years for a single endpoint, like in the case of mammography. You do mammograms on one group, the other group you don't, but the groups are the same. You track them for 25 years, and lo and behold, they find out that those findings, that all the other studies in the meta-analyses that were done, were not right.
Well, what did the old study show about how mammograms saved lives? Wasn't it one life saved out of 5,000 mammograms?
Somewhere between 2,500 and 5,000 mammograms need to be done to save one life. You're looking at numbers that are really
small. And that was with the old statistics.
Well, those are the statistics we go by. And there's all this hullabaloo for that, so you've got to do a lot of mammograms. And when you do, and then you overdiagnose them besides, because when you look at the two groups that they looked at, okay, in this Canadian study, one group had a fixed number of, well, they had a certain number of deaths. And that was the group that had the mammograms over that period of time. And it turned out that that group found more cancers, about 22% more cancers, than in the group that had no mammograms at all.
But weren't a lot of those false positives?
No. Those were the ones that were the real cancers. So 22% more cancers found, real cancers, invasive cancers.
Did it include the DCIS?
No, it didn't even include those, which makes it skewed even worse because those aren't really cancers at all. So what I'm saying here, to make a short sentence out of this, is that the group that had mammography over the 25 years had 22% more cancers found than the group that didn't have mammography. So what is that telling you? Some cancers disappear on their own, and they don't need to be treated. So when they say there's a 15 to 25% reduction in deaths, they're talking about those people that would have been cured anyway. So what does the mammogram do? It makes trouble.
Well, I think most of us know that we get cancer cells that come and go frequently.
Yeah, that's for sure. But these are real cancers. I'm not talking about cancer cells. I'm talking about invasive cancers where you go to the pathologist and say, is this serious? And he says, you darn right it is. But a lot of those cancers, they disappear. Another study was done years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, on 100,000 women who got mammograms on year one, year three, and year five. And they found 2,000 cancers. Another group had mammograms at the end of 5 years, another 100,000 women. There were only 1,500 cancers found in that group. How do you explain that?
Because 500 of them went away on their own then.
Yeah, about 25%. The same numbers they're talking about here, they're taking credit for because they think they've cured them.
But nobody wants to take that gamble. So if they have a mammogram done and it shows that they have a cancer,
of course
they don't want to think, oh, I'm going to just sit and pray and hope that it's going to disappear.
Okay, so what are you better off doing then if you're the governing agency, the medical doctors, the AMA or whoever they are that decides what tests should be done? What would you recommend that they say? It would be simple. Don't do a mammogram because the 22%, you're not going to overdiagnose them, and they're not going to live any longer anyway. So what's the drill for? What does it accomplish? Nothing, except it makes more people get mammograms, get treatment with radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery.
Makes money.
Well, that's what it's about. And so you look at the conclusion, okay, of what this Canadian study said, and they're saying it's not an easy task to make the people of this country aware that we shouldn't be doing mammograms. They can't recommend them because governments, research funders, scientists, medical practitioners may have vested interest in continuing activities that are well established. Amen. That's what's happening.
Well, also, can't the mammograms, the radiation from the mammograms, cause the breast cancer?
Yes. But
so if a woman has a tendency to have breast cancer, or she has a cancer gene, mm-hmm. and then the doctors say, oh, it's really important to get frequent mammograms to follow you.
Yeah.
Couldn't they, in fact, be causing the cancer that they're trying to follow to get it early?
You'd have to think that. Yeah, sure, that would
so
be
so maybe
a risk.
They wouldn't even have gotten it, maybe wouldn't have gotten it so soon, but
okay.
If they're getting the radiation that's so concentrated in that particular area, they could be increasing their risk.
Of course, it would be. I would never have my patients who had, say, the BRCA gene defect get a mammogram. That's just insanity.
But do you think that this is going to get the proper exposure in the media? I mean, there's
no, of course not.
People are brainwashed already about getting mammograms. I mean, people want to follow the bandwagon. They're afraid. They listen to the ads. The celebrities talk about it. Doctors talk about it. The internet. There's prizes given to people for some. I saw something on TV not too long ago where the prize was to get a free mammogram.
Oh,
there's
geez.
Political pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's conflict of interest. But people.
There's a lot of money involved.
The hardest thing is that people are already believing that mammograms save lives. And that's a lot of what these cancer walks are about.
Yeah, of course.
And runs
well,
and
well,
all
look
the
at,
others.
Look at all the money involved and who sponsors the cancer walks, the people that have the most to gain from it. You're looking at things from the American Cancer Society, and you think, oh, they're a sacred organization. They're here trying to protect against us dying from breast cancer. And so let's find the cure for cancer. Well, who do you think funds them? It's the pharmaceutical industry. And why do they do that? Because they make a ton of money when more people get mammograms, because more people are going to get chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. That's money in their back pocket.
So, of course, we don't want to get breast cancer, but when is it useful to get a mammogram?
Well, there are times. I'm not saying don't ever do a mammogram. I think it's a useful test for some things, but not as a screening test on people who are asymptomatic. That's what causes all these problems. You find a lump, get a mammogram, see what it shows. It gives you some kind of idea of what's there.
Then a lot of people say, well, then it's too late if you find the lump.
Well, it might be too late, but what else can you do? You need a better test because it's not going to be a mammogram. Let's go back and take a look at this question of radiation, too, and its cause of cancer, and look at how much different the number of cases is that get cancer, depending on how you test for it. 1 in 9,000 mammograms will lead to a lethal cancer. About 1 in 1,500 mammograms will cause a breast cancer, but you won't die from it except 1 in 9,000. You're going to save a life every 2,500 to every 5,000 mammograms. What kind of numbers are we talking about here? And who's taking advantage of women?
Those are the old numbers anyway, right?
Those are good numbers. Those numbers are fine. But who's going to benefit from all that? Not very many people. And so we're spending billions of dollars to try and stop the epidemic of breast cancer as though it's going to be screening and early detection that solves the problem. That's insanity. Of course, what we should be doing is trying to prevent breast cancer. And don't think we don't know how to do that.
Well, and a lot of this follows with what we were just talking about, too, with these walks and so forth that they're promoting. Because a lot of this is about what we call pinkwashing. Go to our site, drsaputo.com, and put in pinkwashing. Or go to thesafecosmetics.org and put it in. Because a lot of these companies that are sponsoring these walks and things, they make products and manufacture products that actually contain the carcinogens that cause the breast cancer.
Yeah, well, who cares if you're hypocritical as long as you're making a buck? That's the bottom line.
Yeah, and then people that have cancer, sometimes they're offering to give them gifts of makeup and stuff because they've had chemo and they've lost their hair and their eyelashes and their eyebrows, and so they give them cosmetics, but the cosmetics they give them have cancer-causing ingredients in them.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's exactly what's happening, and it's wrong.
And people need to pay attention to where their money goes when they buy something that says for a pink ribbon.
Oh,
because a lot of that is just a gimmick to get you to buy things. So you
can't
really trust it.
Well, everybody buys into it, and you start talking like
this. Yeah, and you go to the cash register, and they say, would you like to donate to this?
Oh, yeah, and then you beat up on the poor person at the cash register who thinks you're a nut, too, because you won't give a buck to help women to cure breast cancer.
And that's not what is happening.
No.
It's not where it's going.
No, we should go towards the cure. We know how to cure breast cancer. I mean, how to prevent breast cancer. We can prevent breast cancer right this second. And it's all about lifestyle. And the toxic environmental compounds that we put in there, there are 100,000 new chemicals in the environment that are changing the genetic makeup that we have. The epigenetics of disease is more important than the genetics by far. If you have the BRCA gene defect, yes, you're at a higher risk for getting breast cancer, but you may never trigger those genes to go off. They never went off 100 years ago because there weren't 100,000 new chemicals that change some of those genes to become toxic.
Of course, some of these chemicals, it's difficult to avoid them.
Well, you can't.
I was just talking to a friend of mine on the phone today that was on an airplane, and she said this mist came into the airplane.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And she's been having a sinus infection ever since. In fact, she said her throat cracked right up immediately as soon as that happened. And we were just on a trip, and I was walking through the restaurant, and I felt this mist come over me and asked somebody what it was, and they said it was to keep the insects away.
Yeah.
Well, so there are a lot of things that are very difficult to prevent ourselves, but we need to prevent the things that we have the control over anyway.
Well, we don't have control over a lot of it, and we're not smart enough to do what we can to take care of ourselves. I'm talking about epigenetics. What's that? Genetics is DNA. DNA is not the boss. DNA gives you options. The environment does a lot, and your lifestyle does a lot to determine whether those cancer genes are going to be turned on or off. If they're turned off, you don't have a problem. Like 100 years ago, the BRCA gene defect didn't make that much difference.
That's what Angelina Jolie had.
Right. But Angelina Jolie now comes out like she's some kind of authority. I mean, she's a marvelous actress. I love to
model.
Watch her. She's terrific.
Beautiful.
As an actress, but what the hell? I mean, a piece in the New York Times that Angelina Jolie says this? Give me a break. We need to be looking at what we can do in our lifestyle to take responsibility for our health. Eat a healthy diet so you have the nutrients you need to be able to prevent the cancers from developing, because we have the products that we need to build our defenses. Get enough sleep. We know that sleep's a problem. We're going to talk about that later in the show. We know that if you don't exercise, a lot of things happen because toxins build up and a lot of other things happen. So we need to make sure that we're doing the things that we can to take care of ourselves. And that's a no-brainer and straightforward. We know that today. Nobody would argue with that.
Hey, now, we didn't mention much about the DCIS. Do you want to touch on
that? Sure. I mean, DCIS is another problem in itself.
Ductal carcinoma in situ.
Right. And that's something that wasn't included in this study that was done up in Canada.
Which was a good thing, huh?
Well, it just showed how bad the other studies that we have been, and it took away the most powerful piece of literature that we have that would have supported it even more. So it makes the study even better. Ductal carcinoma in situ is not cancer 98% of the time. 2 to 3% of the ductal carcinomas in situ will go on and kill you. The other 97 to 98%, you'll die with but not from. So it's not a big issue. But if you've got DCIS, and your doctor says, well, you got a 2 or 3% chance of dying, what do you want to do? Nearly everybody, especially with the encouragement of their oncologist, is going to be doing treatment for it. And so they wind up with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy that 97 to 98% of the time is not necessary. Who benefits from that? All the people that are in the business. That's right. The industry does. Now, you could track these people over time, not with a mammogram, and not with a CT scan, and not with any fancy digital procedures that we do.
But with a breast thermography.
You could use breast thermography, and you could use MRIs. I mean, they're fine. Now, the breast thermography you can afford, because it's like $150 or $200 or something like that.
Same as a mammogram.
Same as a mammogram. And the MRIs, of course, are quite expensive. And when you do the MRIs in certain ways, they require a dye as well, which can be toxic and cause problems that are a real issue. So we're really left with what? Breast thermography. And who on the planet thinks breast thermography is good? Well, for one.
Not the mammographers.
No, but for one. The FDA in 1982 said it was fine as an adjunct to mammography. So what's all the hullabaloo about?
Because they don't want to learn how to do it.
Well, that's part of it. And there was a study that was done that was the biggest study on 283,000 women back in 1982, which at the time, breast thermography was not an advanced study. And they found that after a couple of years, they didn't do it anymore. Because they said it just made more trouble. And at the time, that might have been true. But, I mean, just like mammograms have gotten better, so have the people who do breast thermography. And it's a very good science now. And why people won't look at the research there and the data that's been on 300,000 women is beyond me, because it's good stuff.
We have it all over drsaputo.com. So if anybody wants to learn more about breast thermography, it's easy to find it if you just put it in the search box.
Well, that's right. So we've got a problem. There is a solution. There are many solutions to it. But it's going to be very difficult for the public to wake up and for doctors to wake up and change their thinking that says mammograms aren't a good idea. And here's the data that shows it. And you're going to find a whole bunch of people coming up with all kinds of reasons trying to say, well, this study wasn't right, but it is. They're going to say it's not right because they've got a conflict of interest that's going to support them to do something more because it's somehow providing them with income.
Well, change isn't easy.
No. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on aphorisms that may make you think. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can insomnia increase your risk for getting cancer?
I have some aphorisms to make you think. The nicest thing about the future is that it always starts tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Money will buy a fine dog, but only kindness will make him wag his tail.
That's for sure.
If you don't have a sense of humor, you probably don't have any sense at all.
I like that.
Here's something to think about. Seatbelts. They're not as confining as wheelchairs.
Oh, that's for sure. That's a good one.
A good time to keep your mouth shut is when you're in deep water.
Right on.
How come it takes so little time for a child who's afraid of the dark to become a teenager who wants to stay out all night?
Something big happened there, huh?
Here's one to make you think. Business conventions are important because they demonstrate how many people a company can operate without. That's because they're all at the convention.
That's right. Very good.
Why is it that at class reunions you feel younger than everybody else looks?
Oh, right. I never put my glasses on when I look in the mirror in the morning. I look much younger.
No one has more driving ambition than the teenage boy who wants to buy a car. Isn't that the truth?
Boy, for sure.
There are no new sins. The old ones just get more publicity.
I think you're right.
There are worse things than getting a call for a wrong number at 4 a.m., like it could be the right number.
Oh, you got that right.
No one ever says it's only a game when their team is winning.
Right.
I've reached the age where happy hour is a nap.
I know.
I know you know. The trouble with bucket seats is that not everybody has the same size bucket.
That's for sure.
After 60, if you don't wake up aching in every joint, you're probably dead.
I'm not too smart.
One so get two. Over it.
Right.
Life isn't tied with a bow, but it's still a gift. Forgive others, not because they deserve forgiveness, but because you deserve peace. Amen.
How true. Oh, those are great. Amen. You know, they sound silly, but they're really true.
Yeah.
Well, laughter is
the best. Those are aphorisms.
Okay.
Another word for your vocabulary.
There you go. Mine too.
If we don't get enough sleep, we feel tired and we lack energy, and it can be a hazard on the road. But there are other important reasons to get good quality, unfragmented sleep. Now, in the past, we've talked about the increased risk of inflammation, diabetes, weight gain, depression, reduced libido, hypertension, heart attack, strokes, and even osteoporosis.
Is that all?
Oh, is associated.
Yeah. Don't worry about your sleep. The consequences are only a few diseases.
With lack of sleep. But now a new study shows that poor quality sleep with frequent awakenings can speed cancer growth. In other words, sleep loss can promote cancer. So this is one of the lifestyle measures that we were just talking about before the break.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when you're talking about the importance of sleep, it's huge. I mean, if you just miss 5 hours of sleep one night, your natural killer cells, which protect you against virus infections and what else, cancer, go down 50 to 80%. So you're looking at a huge drop in immunity. The other thing about loss of sleep is that your body goes into an inflamed state. So the markers of inflammation go up and can be measured, and that's been done. They've done some studies on young adults that I found fascinating. They took people in their 20s and put them in a sleep lab. In one group, they let them sleep right through the night, no problem. And they looked at their inflammatory markers when they were done, and they were fine. The other group, they slept through the whole night, just like the first group. But every time they got into deep REM sleep, a little sound went off that prevented them from going into that real deep stuff.
Just enough to bug them.
Just enough to bug them, but not enough to wake up. When they woke up in the morning, they didn't feel very good, and their inflammatory markers were off the charts. So does it make a difference how you sleep? You bet. And we don't get enough in our fast-paced culture. We can always do something more to take a little bit away from sleep, right? Then we get more done.
Well, think about it, too, if you have a restless spouse.
Oh, now you're looking at me. You're looking at me with those big blue eyes.
Somebody that snores.
Do I snore?
Or has restless leg syndrome. Well, you're the one that's saying it's you. I'm just saying people can have this problem.
Yeah, and then the big blue eyes are looking right at me, and you got this big smile with those white pearly teeth. It's okay.
Well,
I still love you.
Or new parents that have a baby that's,
oh, yeah,
you know, that's keeping them awake.
Oh, there's the real example. You're right.
So would it work to take a sleeping pill if you couldn't sleep well?
Well, you could, but there are a lot of consequences of sleeping pills. Now you're thinking like the medical profession. If something goes wrong, take a pill. I think if something goes wrong, find out what the problem is, resolve the problem, you won't need the pill.
Well, I think it's really important for people to treasure their quality and quantity of sleep.
Right. Well, you
they
don't
need
get...
to take care of that like you take care of your bank account.
Yeah, well, you don't get that when you're taking a sleeping pill. You don't go into that deep REM sleep.
Yeah.
And why would you want to temporarily solve a problem? Well, because it's an immediate gratification. You'll sleep through the night. You'll feel better the next day, maybe. But you may feel all hungover, too. Plus, after you take it for a couple of weeks, you build up an immunity to sleep. I mean, you don't have the pill, you can't sleep.
Oh, that's
and then
great.
It doesn't work it very well, and you've got to get off the pill. And you're going to have to solve the reason why you don't sleep anyway. It's because of usually pain or worry or concern. But, I mean, there's a whole range.
Well, you know,
of-
the other night when I read this article, I went to bed and I couldn't go to sleep because I kept thinking about, well, you can get cancer if you don't get enough sleep.
Yeah.
And then I thought, if somebody had cancer, they would be like worrying about how important it would be to go to sleep. And that could keep them awake because, you know, a lot of times when you're like trying really hard to go to sleep, that's when you can't sleep. Or when you think, oh, I have to get up early in the morning. It's really important that I get enough sleep.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
so what do you do when you're in that situation? How do you go to sleep?
In that case, I actually use melatonin for people who have cancer. And we're going to be talking about that in the next segment of this show. So I'll leave it till then. But
we come back after the break.
That's one time. That it makes a lot of sense for the reasons that we'll get into.
Well, another thing people need to be aware of is that, you know, if you have things that are stressing you, it's a good idea to find out some ways to reduce your stress.
Oh.
There's lots of healthy ways that you can reduce stress.
We worry about so many things that we can't control. It's because a lot of us are control freaks because we were trained that way as kids. And we take it right into adult life because when we can't control a situation, if we're taught that we're supposed to or that it's necessary to do, a little button goes off that says, you're not taking control of things. You've got to be in control. And you cannot be in control of a lot of things. You're not in control of somebody else's behavior. You're not in control of what your kids decide to do when they're adults. I mean, you may be able to have some influence, but you're not them. So you have to let go and let God is what I call that, which means you get in touch with those with the problem. You see if it's something that realistically you can solve, but most of the time it's going to be you can give advice, but they're not going to listen to you anyway. So you might as well, if you're a mother, be a mother. If you're a father, be a father and do the best you can to be compassionate and to be understanding, but also not to try and control the outcome of what happens. We have to make our own mistakes, and that's how we learn. And if we live in a place where we try to solve other people's problems and feel obligated to, it really doesn't turn out right.
Another reason that many people have trouble sleeping is from caffeine. And when you think about all the coffee houses and how popular that's become, and I've noticed because I drink decaf that a lot of people are critical or they make fun of that, like, oh, that's not the same thing. Well, to me, it tastes the same, and I like the taste of it. But most people, I guess, like to drink the coffee or the espressos and so forth for the caffeine.
Well, it's a manly thing. I drink real coffee. I don't drink this fake stuff.
But a lot of drugs contain caffeine, and a lot of prescription drugs do. So something to think
about.
Well,
it's addicting, too. I mean, if you don't take caffeine in regularly when you're taking a lot of it, not only do you get headaches, but you're going to have a problem with a lack of energy.
The other thing is alcohol too, because that wears off after a certain amount of time, and then many times people wake up and then they can't go back to sleep. So, but what I want to know is, do naps count to make up for lost sleep? Do you know that?
I think they do. Yes, and there have been studies on that. The power nap, you know, just 20 minutes can do a lot. And I can tell you, when I was an intern and a resident, if I could get a 5-minute nap standing up, that helped me a lot to focus a lot clearer.
Like a horse.
Well, you got that right.
Well, another thing, too, is to dim the lights in your house before you go to bed and get the technology out of your bedroom to get rid of those electromagnetic fields.
Exactly.
Make sure your room temperature's right. You might want to wear earplugs if your partner snores. If you have sleep apnea, get that taken care of.
Sure.
iPads in the morning when the light comes in if you haven't had enough sleep yet.
Right, and don't expose yourself to blue or white lights at night. Those light bulbs will affect your melatonin, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment. So really what you want to use is a colored light, and we'll talk about which colors are
so
right
not
ones.
Getting enough sleep can actually make tumors more invasive, and like going to the muscle and the bone
exactly.
And all that sort of thing. So get your shut-eye.
Okay. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. And we'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about Can melatonin cure or make breast cancer improve? Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
Many of us like to read or watch TV or text or work on our computers at night before we go to bed. But it turns out that artificial light at night shuts down on our production of the hormone melatonin from the pineal gland in our brain. So melatonin regulates our body's sleep and awake cycles, and it turns out that not enough of it may be increasing our risk for cancer. Now, melatonin has been shown to prevent cancer in new research from Detroit and San Paulo that show melatonin slowing the growth of certain breast cancer tumors. So we really need to take our sleep seriously.
Oh, for sure. And what we're looking at is an article that was published in the Public Library of Science, okay, in the January issue of 2014. And what it showed is that melatonin can inhibit tumor growth and it can slow down cell production. It can block the formation of new blood vessels, with which cancer cells absolutely must have or they cannot grow.
That's angiogenesis, called,
huh? That's right. That's what that is. And they did this in women who had breast cancer. So this is something that's really interesting because what we have here is what looks like a chemotherapy that's a relatively natural one that could be used in people who have breast cancer, but there's research on many other kinds of cancers as well.
Well, they also said in this study that it enhances the effect of chemotherapy and radiation.
Well, that's your American Cancer Society for you. What are they saying? Oh, yes, it could be helpful, but only, okay, do we recommend it if it involves the use of chemotherapy or radiation, because that's their orientation.
Well, if you do have breast cancer, it sounds safer than chemo. And if you're in stage four, what's to lose, you know? But it's a good idea to have supervision with it, not just be taking it on your own.
Well, think of it this way, Vicki. Would you rather get into some clinical trial, okay, that's using a chemotherapy agent that's never been proven, that's probably going to have toxic effects that are may even kill you? Would you rather do that or try something like melatonin? And do you really need your doctor to give you permission to do that? Now, it would be good to have your doctor supervise that, but what doctor would say, no, I think we better put you in a clinical trial because these studies that were done on melatonin, what's that? Because we think that way, because we're a drug-oriented doctor group.
Well, I know that you're not supposed to give advice on the radio, for example.
For sure.
But what do you recommend to your patients? Like, for example, if somebody says that they have jet lag and they're having trouble sleeping because uh-huh. their circadian rhythms are all messed up from the jet lag, and they want to take melatonin, what dose would you recommend for that compared to what you might recommend to somebody that has cancer that okay. wanted to take melatonin and try that?
All right. For my patients, I recommend a dose of 1 to 3 milligrams of melatonin if it's for jet lag. And less is probably effective as well, keeping in mind that it's thousands of times more than what the pineal gland makes in melatonin in the human body. If somebody has cancer, I mean, because it has all these other potential things to benefit the cancer, and they can't sleep particularly, I go with 20 milligrams a day and see how they tolerate it. Because you might as well go with a dose that's substantial. It's not really been shown to have any big negative effects. So up to this point, we don't really know the downsides of what melatonin does.
Well, our bodies have a checks and balance system, and taking extra hormones on a whim could be an unknown health risk.
Well, I don't recommend people take melatonin for anything. I don't even recommend it for jet lag. I think the right thing to do is to try and get on the time zone that you're with. So when you arrive and it's like 3 a.m. your time, but it's 3 p.m. where you're landing, I wait until nighttime to go to bed, and then your melatonin will kick in by itself and get you back on schedule pretty quickly.
Well, especially if you're aware about the artificial lights at night, because that's what really messes with your melatonin. So we need to cut the TV and the computer and the reading before we go to bed at night.
Well, ideally,
and to start dimming.
Right.
dimming the lights, but then you might say, well, what am I going to do?
Yeah, right. Just sitting here for with an hour with nothing to do.
Be with each other or start getting ready for bed.
Well, you know, like before we had lights, we had campfires, right? And we used to sit around the campfire, or we'd sit around talking by candlelight or something like
or
that.
Or a fire, yeah. But, you know, artificial lights are considered a form of pollution.
Oh, they are.
So
they're even considered a carcinogen or a probable carcinogen by the World Health Organization, because a lack of melatonin does put you at risk for cancer.
As does working the night shift.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you may get a 30 to 40% increase in the risk of breast cancer if you're on the night shift for a number of years. So that's a real thing. So whether you have the light on for an hour or just a second when you get up in the middle of the night, the effect is the same. And your melatonin pump turns off. And it doesn't just flip back on when you turn the light off. It takes time. And so
up to an hour before you go to bed, it's important to dim the lights and only use low wattage yellow, orange, or red light bulbs.
Right.
If necessary.
Well, they
like salt lamps, for example.
Yeah, that would be great.
That are 5 watts.
Yeah, what you don't want is the white light or blue lights, because that's what really triggers your pineal to turn off.
The other thing is to get bright sunlight in the morning for at least like 15 minutes, because that'll reset your circadian rhythm.
Well, that's right. Well, we have to look at some of the things that melatonin does.
First, I wanted to add one more thing before we got into that.
All right.
It's like if you have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom or for whatever reason you need to, it's better not to turn on the bright light when you go so that you can see.
Right.
Kill yourself
by running into something.
You don't want to fall. But if you got one of these light bulbs we were talking about, these little salt lamps or the 5-watt, you know, yellow, orange, or red light bulbs.
Yeah.
Because even if the bright light is on for just a few seconds or an hour,
whatever it is,
it's going to mess up that whole circadian rhythm.
All right. So if you're older or you have neuropathy, okay, and you can't feel your feet very well or your balance isn't good, you don't want a dark room at night, but you also don't want a white light or a blue light. So in your night light, get a nice orange or yellow colored light or red light. So you can still see, but make sure that you don't kill yourself on that hard bathroom floor, because that's, you know, you fall down there, that's where the hip fractures
occur. The other thing you do not want in your bedroom are any of the electromagnetic fields.
Well, that's
like
another
you
story.
Don't want to keep your computer in there charging up and your cell phone in there charging
right.
up and
right.
your iPad and iPod and all the rest of that.
Well, electromagnetic pollution is another story. If you want to learn about it, go to the website, drsaputo.com, and you can learn about it.
But complete darkness is the answer. Personally, what I do is I wear iPads.
Uh-huh. That's a great way. But when you get up in the middle of the night, you don't turn the lights on. You don't have iPads on. Although
no.
I very often go by Braille because I know where everything is, and I kind of just I just feel my way
on. One time I got mixed up.
I know. You woke me up. I don't know where you were going or what you were dreaming.
I was trying to get into the cabinet where my sweaters were.
I know. Well, it's not a good place to go to the bathroom. You're right.
Well, anyway, even like if you have an alarm clock that has a light on it, they recommend not doing that in your room either, covering that over.
Well, the one we have actually has a blue light. I don't know if you noticed that.
But you can't see it anyway unless you push your finger on the top of it.
Which is not good. It should be a red or a yellow or an orange one. So we may have to look at that. We could put a filter over
it. Well, I don't usually look at my alarm in the middle of the night anyway.
Oh, sometimes I do because I'm just curious what time it is. But other things that it does, I mean, if you don't have enough melatonin, it's a powerful antioxidant, you don't get the benefit of reducing inflammation. But you also need to have it to stimulate your immune system, because a lack of it will actually cause your thymus gland to atrophy, and it's very much connected with immune capacity. And it also may have a role in slowing aging process of your brain if there's not enough there. So we need to keep in mind that melatonin is something that is a very important hormone that regulates all the hormone systems in our body. And when we have cancer, it's a different situation than we don't have cancer. I think it's okay to use a little bit more, but under the supervision, of course, with your healthcare practitioner. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on more of Vicki's favorite quotes. I like those. And when we come back, we'll be talking about How can third-hand smoke, be more dangerous than smoking itself? And then, how can friendly bacteria help us to lose weight?
Oh, I have a few of my favorite quotes to share. If you're depressed, you're living in the past. If you're anxious, you're living in the future. If you're at peace, you are living in the present.
Ah, that's the gift of the present.
So with that, remember, life is short. Live it to the fullest because it has an expiration date.
That's right.
Nobody can change a person, but someone can be the reason for a person to change.
For sure.
Sorry works when a mistake is made, but not when trust is broken. So in life, make mistakes, but never break trust. Because forgiving is easy compared to forgetting and trusting again, which is sometimes impossible.
Right. Well, Vicki, you're my wingman. Thank you.
I have some wise words to live by Pablo Picasso. The meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of life is to give it away.
Perfect.
Isn't that a good one?
Absolutely.
So, first-hand smoke, second-hand smoke, what in the dickens is third-hand smoke?
Right.
Who would have ever dreamed that smoking could have such far-reaching unhealthy effects?
Maybe we shouldn't smoke. What do you think?
Well, remember all the old movies? Everybody smoked.
Right. John Wayne. I'd walk a mile for a camel,
right? Well, now scientists say second- and third-hand smoke are just as deadly as smoking. So we're going to discuss how secondhand smoke that gets left on the surfaces of objects turns into thirdhand smoke, becoming progressively more toxic with time, and the carcinogens linger and persist.
Right. So when you come to our house, you can't smoke.
Remember that.
It's a bad idea to smoke to start with, and blowing smoke in us is a bad idea. But the residue that you leave after you left stays here while you're gone. No thanks.
Well, smoke, you remember that song, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes?
Oh, yeah.
So smoke gets in your clothes, your car, the taxi,
right.
The curtains, the furniture, the hotel rooms, your home, the dust, everything.
Yeah.
If you live with a smoker, you are in trouble.
You bet. Not just the smoker. And the damage that occurs is in your liver and your lungs for sure. And wounds don't heal very well. And I think it also causes some hyperactivity in mice that are exposed to
and
that.
You know,
as well.
What's interesting is that smokers many times get angry when you tell them things like this. They don't want to hear it.
No, well,
they don't want to believe it. But now it's proven.
Well, they know it. I mean, who smokes wants to continue to smoke? I remember seeing a little thing on the internet of a 2-year-old kid from the Orient someplace that did chain smoking. It was unbelievable. This kid was a pro at smoking, and the amount of smoke in the room was unbelievable. The parents had just got to be totally ignorant.
Well, did you see the one on email where the little kids in Indonesia were going around asking adults that were smoking for a light, holding cigarettes, all the adults started telling them the dangers of smoking?
Oh, that's cool.
And so then the kids had these little pieces of paper that were already written out that they handed to them, telling them, why do you care more about us than you do about yourself?
Oh, cool. Well, that's right.
Yeah. So anyway, like you said, you know, wounds take longer to heal. So if somebody has been around third-hand smoke and you have surgery, might be a problem.
Oh, I mean, talk to the surgeons. They want you off tobacco for as long as possible because there's nothing like delayed wound healing.
But up until now, we didn't know that it would the effects of the third-hand smoke.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, that's important. And this was published in the Public Library of Science, so it's a solid article that really tells us that this is something that we have to pay
attention
to.
Well, we already know it damages the lungs, and it's not good for our hearts. And you see these ads on TV about people having leg amputations and so forth.
Oh, peripheral vascular disease is huge.
But what about hyperactivity? I didn't know about that before.
Well, it causes hyperactivity in mice, and I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be a similar problem for people.
So it could happen to your kids. Your kids could be hyperactive because you have residual left in your house or your car from thinking that could smoke when they weren't in the car with you.
In the house. So if they've got ADHD, just, you know, buy some more Ritalin, huh? Is that what they do? It's a silly way that we solve problems.
Well, it can
like
even contribute to diabetes, and we know that in the respiratory things, you know, like asthma and COPD and
lung
cancer and cardiovascular disease. So now the effects are clear about this third-hand smoke. And also they found that children of smoking parents are absent from school something like 40% more.
Wow. Well, Well, that doesn't really surprise me. I mean, the whole thing about smoking, we know about. And it's the kind of thing, you know, when you start in childhood, as most people do, they're smoking when they're in their teens. And that's the best time that you can get addicted to it. I mean, by the time you've been on it for a few years, you got major problems. And it's the kind of thing that doesn't just, it's not easy to break. I mean, breaking the habit of nicotine addiction is a huge problem. It's harder for people to do that sometimes than to stop drinking.
Well, it's harder now than what it used to be because they put ingredients in cigarettes to make you become addicted even more because they want to sell more.
Well, the tobacco industry is a business, end of story. And what they want to do is sell product. They don't care about what happens to kids or adults or anybody else. They just want you to buy it. And so they're doing all the kinds of things they can. You know, the Marlboro T-shirts and hats that are often seen at racing events. I mean, it's a terrible thing that people will resort to things like that when they know that it's not the right thing to do.
Well, many times we think that it's the smell, you know, that's the giveaway. I remember when I was a teenager and my friends and I would smoke in the bathroom.
Well, it made you big shots, right?
And we'd open the window and we'd think we were blowing it out the window.
Right.
And then my mother would be outside the door and we'd spray it all down with hairspray.
She would have figured everything out.
Thinking we were fooling her. It was interesting that she didn't say anything, but she had to know.
Of course she knew. I'm surprised she was as thoughtful about not bringing it up. Because it's a big deal. I mean, tobacco smoking is very addictive. It causes all these health issues that we know about. And what we'll do to have, really, it's a social thing. To make us feel like we're important, we'll smoke. Or to be like somebody else.
Well, it used to be that way more. I don't think it's that way so much anymore.
Well, there's so much publicity about this now that it's a wrong thing to do. I think people are finally getting the idea that's the wrong way to go.
Well, you know, there's so many diet gimmicks out there. Like weight loss is big business. It's a $52 billion business.
Yeah, for sure.
And many diet pills have been pulled off the market for causing everything from heart attacks to strokes and liver damage. Things like FinFin, Hydroxycut, Meridia, Ephedra, Redux, and the list goes on. And we've seen a lot of these ads on television in the past. But then there's Alestra, the fat substitute that gives people oily stools. And the latest fad now is this Garcinia Cambogia and green coffee bean extract. So it's going to be interesting to see how these play out. But
we have to look at what's going on when they have a problem with obesity. It is very complicated. And it's not just a simple solution to use some kind of pill that's going to stop it. There are many factors that are endocrine or social that have to do with abuse of different types that we really should be paying attention to. And I think that we have an incredible selection on our website at drsabuda.com. If you put weight management in there in the search box, and by the way, this is a completely free website. You don't pay 1 cent for this. It costs us money to keep this website alive as a public service. So you should all out there be looking at the site. It's got 2,500 audios and videos on it that are made by Vicky and me ourselves. And then we have created different health assessments, some of which have to do with weight management or with diabetes or hypertension or high cholesterol or whatever. They take about 3 or 4 minutes to take. And once you take the assessment, immediately comes back all these audios and videos are the ones we think need to listen to be able to get an idea of what you need to learn to be able to deal with your situation, whatever it is. So when it comes to weight loss, that's a good one to do. Take the health assessment. Again, it's free. There's nothing on our site that's informational that costs you 1 cent. So again, it's drsaputo.com.
Well, the benefits of probiotics aren't new, but to help women lose weight? Now, this sounds like a healthy way to promote a healthy weight.
It does.
Now, how can friendly bacteria help women lose weight? Yeah, so we're going to talk about this study from Quebec.
Okay. Well, yeah, this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition in January 2014. And basically, what they showed is that the intestinal flora of obese individuals is different from those people who are thin. And they wondered if it was the microbes that were there that had something to do with causing them to overeat and to become overweight or obese.
Well, obese have more fat and they're lower in fiber.
Yeah, well, okay, that may be. But at the same time, they're looking at the microbes that live there. And what they found was, when they looked at 125 overweight men and women, that the subjects, that each of these subjects underwent a 12-week weight loss diet that was followed by 12 weeks afterwards of maintaining their body weight. And throughout the study, they gave participants two pills a day of a probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus. The other half got a placebo. And what they found after the first 12 weeks is that there was an average weight loss of 4.4 kilograms in women in the probiotic group and about 2.6 kilograms in the study. So you're looking at something like about 10 pounds, okay, in one and maybe something like six in the other. And what happened is they had a maintenance period following this, and the weight of the women in the placebo group stayed about the same as it was when they lost the weight. But the probiotic group continued to lose weight. And the reason probably for that is because the microbes have already taken residence in there, and you don't have to continue to take more probiotic for a while to keep that balance of bacteria that's heavy in the Lactobacillus rhamnosus family. And they continued to lose weight, which was amazing. They actually lost twice as much weight over the entire 24-week period than the people who were in the placebo group.
And most of these bacteria that you're mentioning are in yogurt.
They can be, yes. Now, the strange thing about this is it didn't work in men. And that to me makes no sense. It makes me skeptical about it. Because to my way of thinking, probably what you eat is what determines what kinds of microbes are going to live in the gut. So people.
Well, that's why I was mentioning the high fat and low fiber.
Yeah. So it's the other way around in my mind. And the fact that it didn't work in men makes me wonder what else is going on. It may have something to do with altering the level of leptin, which is a appetite regulating hormone that's in our fat cells that when it's secreted, it turns off our appetite. So if it increases the production of leptin, that would tend to cause a reduction in our appetite. Now, maybe there's some connection there that we don't know about. Of course, they didn't talk too much about this in the study. But to me, it's just fascinating because it could be that the kinds of microbes that live in our gut do a lot more than what we think.
Well, you know, I found this recipe that has yogurt in it. And yesterday, I felt like I ate too much of it. It was so good. It tasted like dessert, and I lost another pound.
Really?
Yeah, and so I just wanted to share it. It's called refrigerator oatmeal, and you can probably just go online and find it. In fact, that was how I happened to come across it. And the recipe calls for oats, you know, rolled oats, yogurt, milk, vanilla, and then your choice of sweetener, like honey or maple syrup or organic jam, your fruit of choice, and it tastes so good.
It does. I had some of it. I loved it.
So you let it sit for like 4 hours, and then it's like it cooks it, so to speak, you know, because you don't have to cook it. But if you like batter, it kind of tastes like batter, actually. I like batter.
I know.
But they also had recipes for smoothies and where you could add peanut butter and chocolate and play around with it. But my favorite happened to be the raspberry. But anyway, it's a great recipe. And I was thinking, well, that has the probiotics in it. Maybe that helped me lose the weight.
Yeah, see, well, no matter what happens here, the concept of taking a probiotic is a good one because the ecosystem in our gut is a very complex ecosystem, and it has 1,000 different species of microbes there, and it has more microbes than we have cells in our body tenfold. So we should be nourishing that.
Well, probiotics have so many benefits anyway that it doesn't hurt to
go to the website and learn about probiotics if you don't know about it, because it's really important. Well, at the end of the show, and I want to remind you that we're back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's radio show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed in video and free access to more than 2,500 audio and video files, click on Health Headlines on the DrSaputo.com homepage. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life. And don't forget to include enough sleep.
All right. See you next time.